You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, November 29th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Not in the literal, however, in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I'm giggling. I'm a little bit discombobulated. Why? Because I am recording this in the past, but pretending it's the future. The future being Thursday, November 29th, which is the day after my birthday. Last night, I'm going to pretend that I had a huge celebration. One of my investment banker friends rented out the top five floors of the Empire State Building. Stephen Perry from Aerosmith played. Tyler Perry was there. I don't know who that is. The guy from Two and a Half Men was there.
I heard always reliable good friend John Benjamin planned the whole thing.
John Benjamin catered it.
He catered it?
Yes. One thing that people don't realize is that John Benjamin is actually just a wonderful, wonderful pastry chef. I, of course, had Neil Young played as well, and Rod Stewart.
Soros funded it all.
And George Soros paid for all of it. And so, today, and by today I mean literally as you hear this, even though I recorded it yesterday, but today I'm extremely hungover. And now that I'm older and more mature, I realized I should tape something in advance. Well, the truth be told, folks, we're doing a tech day. We're probably in the office right now or trying to figure out, working on some video technical issues and trying to develop an app. At one point, we may do a fundraiser for that. But however, that being said, for today, I have two new interviews for you. The first is with the great Dave Zirin of edgeofsports.com and writer at The Nation magazine on the death of Marvin Miller. A very important figure in labor rights in this country. Dave will tell us more. And then we'll hear from Alan Charney, who is from U.S. Action, a community organizing group that is agitating around the grand bargain. And there's some events happening this weekend. Nothing to sneeze at today, ladies and gentlemen. And we will be back live tomorrow with Cliff Schechter and, I believe, the wonderful Isabel Gillies. So sit back, enjoy this interview with Dave Zirin, all new material, and Alan Charney. See you tomorrow live. Happy birthday to me. It's a little gift to myself. There's no reason why I shouldn't. So, there you go. Plus, hopefully my voice will be back. I'll feel a little bit better on Friday. Look, I don't need to justify this to you. So just enjoy the interview. See you later. We are back on the Majority Report. Sam Cedar here on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to this program Dave Zirin. He is the sports and politics writer for The Nation. You can also check him out at edgeofsports.com or follow him on Twitter at edgeofsports. Welcome back, Dave.
Hey, great to be here, Sam.
So, Dave, I primarily want to talk to you about Marvin Miller, who just passed away. I also want to touch on hockey because Matt here in the office is a big hockey fan, and he's afraid he's not going to see any hockey at all this year, and I think he might be right.
His fears are well-founded.
Indeed. All right, well, let's start with Marvin Miller. Who was Marvin Miller?
Sure. Marvin Miller passed away at 95. He was just the other day, and he's arguably the most influential labor leader since World War II in the United States. He was the head of the Major League Baseball Players Association from 1966 to 1982, and he really brought a sense of unionism, solidarity, and frankly, manhood to the players of Major League Baseball. I mean, this was a union before he went there from working with the steelworkers. That was in absolute tatters. The typical player made somewhere between $6,000 and $7,000 a year. They had no freedom of movement. They had no freedom to play where they wanted to play. They had no freedom in terms of determining their trainers, their doctors, safety. I mean, they really were treated like chattel. I mean, you had a couple of decently paid players, like Mickey Mantle was making $100,000 a year. But the average player, and by average, I mean the overwhelming majority of players, took jobs in the off season, oftentimes working at a quarry or a typical manual labor just to make ends meet. Marvin Miller gets in there. He fights for workers' rights. He treats it like a real union. He fights for free agency. And because of all of this, during his tenure as head of the Major League Baseball Players Association, salaries went up astronomically. I mean, during his tenure alone, it went from the average salary being under $10,000 a year to being about $240,000 a year, and today it's over $3 million a year. But in addition to that, and this is far more important, he changed the sport for everyone. I mean, he made owners insanely rich, even though they despised him so much they kept him out of the Hall of Fame past his death. He still is not in the Hall of Fame, which is absolutely ludicrous. But he did more than that. I mean, any sense that we have now of sports as a big business, as sports as something that's expanded into most major cities in the country, as sports as a global entity, and any sense of competitive balance in sports is the result of Marvin Miller unshackling the ankles on the modern player, bringing free agency, bringing freedom of movement, and actually opening up the eyes to people of how entertaining sports can be.
So wait, so how did, and we should say, I mean, you say that he helped the owners make the astronomical sums that they now make too. Where were they in terms of when he became head of the union? where were the owners at that point? I mean, the gulf between – I'm trying to get a sense of the gulf of between what the players were making and what the owners were making at that time. And then tell us how he ended up making the owners so rich.
Well, because Marvin Miller grew the pie. And when Marvin Miller took over, you're talking about a split of owners' revenue to players' revenue that was overwhelmingly in favor of owners. I mean, we're talking, like, in some sports, and by the way, that is worth noting, is Marvin Miller's example influenced every single major sport, right, which is why there were sentiments sent out yesterday from all of the major sports about his passing. But we're talking about 90-10 revenue shares. We're talking 85-15. We're talking about a situation where players were getting a pittance of what was a small pie. And owning a sports team tended to be a family business. It was something that you could buy for a couple $100,000 down. I mean, if you look back at what George Steinbrenner, for example, put down in his own money to buy the Yankees in the early 1970s, I mean, it's comically ridiculous how little money it took to actually buy into a major league franchise. And yet when Marvin Miller took it over, when Marvin Miller took over the union, what he did was he worked on making sure that players would be able to go to different teams. This infuriated owners who saw players as little more than chattel. But by allowing players freedom of movement, it opened up the possibility of competitive balance in sports. And once you have competitive balance, you have fan interest. And once you have fan interest, then the world is your oyster. Because all of a sudden, these owners who had these teams, which were kind of like, you know, Florida swampland that you had for decades with the hope that they would grow. I mean, the Yankees were losing money in the late 60s. Mm. So the hope was that, oh, my gosh, if I hold on to this swampland, someday it'll be decent. You go from that to these being some of the most valuable properties in the world with insane returns for their investors.
Yeah, so let's also talk about, you touched on this, but it seems to me that as baseball went, we then saw football and then ultimately basketball and perhaps to a certain extent hockey as well. I mean, this whole notion that the players were no longer sort of like, you know, I'm like baseball cards are to kids in some respects, you know, that they were actually, there was actually a worker capital dynamic that was going on here, despite the fact that ultimately, you know, players may make a lot of money, but, you know, those are only ones that make it to the major leagues. How did it also implicate the other sports?
Hugely. And like I said, Billy Hunter, head of the NBA Players Association, as well as Damaris Smith of the NFL Players Association, both put out well wishes because about after Miller's death, they are incredibly heartfelt, and people should go online and read them because they all get what Miller did. I mean, Miller, what he did was he ripped from the eyes of the players and from fans as well. Like, he's seen often critically as someone who stole the innocence from fans. Well, boo-hoo. And he stole the innocence from players, boo-hoo, because what he did was he opened their eyes to the fact that you did have a labor-capital dynamic in sports, that this wasn't the case of, hey, you're an adult playing a kid's game. You should feel, which was actually the approach even of George Meany, the head of the AFL-CIO, was he didn't take baseball players or any athletes seriously as actual workers. And it was Marvin Miller who said, well, no, you're workers because you create wealth. Your workers, because your actions on that field are the engine of all the money that goes into this sport. And without you playing, there's no more money. Simple as that. No one's going to buy a ticket to watch somebody sit in an owner's box. And so under Marvin Miller's tenure, you have numerous work stoppages from 1966 to 1982. It earned him terrible enmity amongst the ownership ranks. And it's why, and this is just the ultimate slap in the face or bizarro world, or whatever you want to call it, Bowie Kuhn, the Major League Baseball commissioner, whose clock Marvin Miller cleaned repeatedly in negotiations, is in the Baseball Hall of Fame, but Marvin Miller is not.
Talk to me a little bit about the reserve clause and what that is and what the implications were of – was it Flood who had brought up the case? Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, and you can't tell the Marvin Miller story without telling the story of Curt Flood. And Marvin Miller, who I interviewed several times the last time when he was in his late 80s, he went out of his way to speak about Curt Flood, who passed away in 1999. I believe he was 56 at the time. It was actually a very sad end to Curt Flood's life. But without Curt Flood, you don't get any of this. I mean, you got to look at it like if Marvin Miller was the engine, Curt Flood was the steam running through the engine. The reserve clause was a part of baseball contracts going back to the end of the 19th century. And what it did was it bound players to the team that originally signed them. And the only way you couldn't be on that team anymore is if you were traded or if the team threw you on the scrap heap and said, well, we don't want your services anymore. There was no sense that, like, you could sign a contract, the contract could end, and then you could play somewhere else, or that you could demand a trade. I mean, that was just, like, unheard of, the idea of demanding a trade. And what Curt Flood did was he said to Bowie Kuhn in a letter that I will no longer be a well-paid slave. And those words were, I mean, the opening shots for free agency. And Curt Flood's case went all the way to the Supreme Court with Marvin Miller at his side. And Curt Flood actually lost that case. And when Curt Flood came back into Major League Baseball, and this was somebody who was a lifetime 290 hitter, he'd won a ton of gold gloves. He came back and played for the Washington Senators, and he was a pariah even in his own locker room. I mean, that's how out there he was seen. Like, even the other players didn't want anything to do with him, and he left the sport. But what it did, though, was it was one of those things where it opened up a discussion. Like, even in losing, Curt Flood changed all of the dynamics that were going on in baseball in terms of how players saw themselves relative to owners. And then only a couple of years later, you had Dave McNally and Andy Messersmith, and they became the first players to actually win free agency. And once that happened, I mean, you see this explosion in salaries take place. And with the explosion in salaries, you also see this explosion of fan interest. And with the explosion in fan interest, you see expansion. And then you see all these things, which I think we're right to be very critical of with sports, which is like the size of the athletic industrial complex, its influence. These are in a lot of ways the ugly babies of Marvin Miller, like the fact like billions of dollars in public money going to stadiums. So it was really he who really took the genie out of the bottle and said, like, look how huge this thing can be.
How much did like the reaction to Flood? I mean, it's sort of just I don't know enough about the history of baseball at that time. It just the reaction to Flood sort of seems surprising to me, and I wonder if it wasn't also wrapped up in what was happening socially at that time. I mean, he filed suit in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, that's right. It was baseball. It's got to understand is that baseball was the most conservative
right.
of all the sports that were going on right now. Players tended to come from the American South. Both white players and black players tended to come from the American South. And they tended to come from very small towns. Now, Curt Flood was from Oakland, California. Now, Oakland in the late 60s was, of course, a hotbed. And he was very much influenced by the 1960s. By the black freedom struggle, by the civil rights movement, as Marvin Miller was as well. And so both Curt Flood and Marvin Miller saw themselves as civil rights people. They saw themselves as the baseball version of what was happening in other sports, like Bill Russell in basketball, Muhammad Ali in boxing, Jim Brown in football. But what do all those sports have in common? They're not baseball.
Right.
And you would look you would look far and wide to find baseball players in the 60s who were part of this era of athletic revolt. It just didn't happen. I mean, one player who was Jim Boughton, the iconoclastic pitcher who wrote Ball 4. I've talked with Jim Boughton about this and about efforts, for example, of him to, like, enlist teammates in social issues. And it's just he could get nowhere. And it was very difficult. I mean, one of those reasons was there were just fewer numbers of African-American players in baseball, and that meant less influence of the civil rights movements in baseball. But it was really also that it was a very conservative sport where players had very little social power. So why would you rock the boat in that context? And Curt Flood found himself a pariah in the early 1970s. Now, today, a lot of players praise his name because they know what he did and what he sacrificed. But at the time, it was very, very difficult going for him.
Yeah, I mean, it seems, I mean, it's hard for me not to imagine that there wasn't a certain amount of, I don't know if necessarily racism, but at least to some degree. I mean, you have all these sort of social emancipation movements that are happening across the country. And it is hard to imagine any other, you know, any sport more likely to perceive the dirty hippies as dirty hippies than guys, you know, baseball guys. And
yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's so funny because we always look back at 1972, that era. That was the era of Curt Flood, was 1972. And that was, of course, also the year of, you know, Nixon's silent majority, winning 49 states. I mean, so and you also remember that year, you also had so much of the U.S. labor movement, the official movement, pulling away from McGovern,
right?
Which is why he only won one state. So then we ask ourselves the question, it's like, okay, so you have this country in 72 that's both seems very radical, but also where Richard Nixon wins 49 states. Where is Marvin Miller politically? Where is Curt Flood politically? Well, they're with the one state. Those were their politics. And so you can imagine when you transplant that on as a conservative element like a Major League Baseball locker room, how difficult it was for Curt Flood. He would have been a lot better off in a different sport, that's for sure.
What do you think the chances now of Miller ending up in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, Marvin always said that they would elect him when he was dead. And he also always used the Groucho Marx line, well, I'd never want to belong to any club that would have someone like me as a member. So I think the chances are very good that as the Veterans Committee, which would vote for Marvin Miller, like as they become comprised overwhelmingly of players who benefited from free agency, I think he gets in very easily. But honestly, like I'll repeat the words of what Reggie Jackson said yesterday. Like he said, like, look, or I think it was actually Joe Morgan who said this. He said, look, I don't care if he gets in now. I wouldn't have cared if he got in a year ago. He should have got in 30 years ago.
Right.
So we would have had 30 years to enjoy it with his family.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I appreciate you talking to us about that. Now, give me a brief update for the sake of Matt. I haven't been a hockey fan in probably, I don't know, 30 years myself. But well, is he going to have any hockey? What's going on with the with hockey?
It's the revenge against Marvin Miller. That's what's happening in hockey. I mean, you have a unified lockout strategy by ownership, something that would have been unheard of in Marvin Miller's time, where they went on strikes, where they weren't locked out. And the problem, though, is that the owners are actually doing very well in hockey, yet a minority of them are doing very badly. So what you have is actually a battle between owners that are making money and owners that are losing money, and they're choosing to settle their own economic crisis on the backs of players by extracting salary back from them, which players had just given back a few years ago when they adopted a hard cap and the entire season was canceled. So hockey's a disaster. They're trying to set a land speed record and how fast they can repel their fan base. Mm. And that's what happens, though, when – I mean, I think sports is way too beautiful to put owners in charge of. So that's part of the problem, is that when you put owners in charge of something like this, it's like King Midas in reverse. Anything they touch turns to crap, and they are turning hockey to crap right now.
It sort of feels like the strength of labor in the context of sports is sort of obviously paralleled, and there's, I guess there's no reason why it shouldn't, but that of what we're seeing in terms of the broader society. Not necessarily, it seems like, on a dollars level, but just in terms of the way that they perceive themselves in relationship to the owners and how much unity there is, maybe.
No, absolutely. I mean, since 2010, the number of lockouts in the United States has doubled. It's a product of economic crisis and austerity. You know, and it used to be the third rail of labor management relations, the idea that you would just lock the doors and keep your workers out. And so many people who are now sports owners, they're not like the old days where it was the family business handed down. It's people who made billions of dollars in other industries, usually finance, who then buy a major team, and they're only looking at bottom lines. They come from industries that are employing lockouts, and they see it as an effective tool because they win at the end when they get more money. Unfortunately, who that leaves out is not just players, but people like Matt. It's fans. It's people who work at the stadium. And it's a real tragedy, especially because, as we've seen in this era of public funding of stadiums, right. Why do we really need owners again? I mean, the Green Bay Packers have shown that you don't actually need owners to have pro sports. And I think they should be very, very careful with how much they're pissing off their fan bases in all of these sports.
I love it. Let's get rid of the owners.
That's what I'm saying.
All right.
If Green Bay could win a Super Bowl that way, why not? Why isn't what's good for Green Bay good for America?
Short of maybe too much dairy products in general, I would say absolutely. Let's do it. Dave Zirin, you can check him out at edgeofsports.com. And, of course, at The Nation Magazine. Always a pleasure. Really appreciate you taking the time.
My privilege. Our slogan should be not just lactose intolerant, but owner intolerant.
I love it. All right. Thanks, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Daniel Hall goes on like a frozen freight train. You know that I help you if I can, but I'm just a raindrop in a river, just a little itty-bitty grain of sand. And you know that I'm doomed to repeat this with all the bad habits that I learned, but it's better than your fiber and fornication and all the dirty money.
All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome to the program Alan Charney. He is the program director for U.S. Action. Welcome to the program, Alan.
Well, thank you very much.
So, all right, U.S. Action, just tell us briefly about your organization.
Oh, we're a progressive grassroots organizing network in active in 22 states. We have affiliates in those states. Including Citizen Action of New York and New Jersey Citizen Action, Progress Ohio, Virginia Organizing, Washington Community Action Network. We're active in 22 states, and we work on a variety of state and federal issues from a progressive perspective. And right now we're very active around the whole fight of around the fiscal showdown, the Bush tax cuts for the top 2%, defending Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, and other issues that Congress is currently taking up.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. You guys are engaging. I mean, I've spoken quite a bit on this program about the supposed fiscal cliff and the opportunity that those foes of our social insurance programs are taking right now to use the potential for coming austerity or the debt crisis or the so-called debt crisis or the so-called or the debt ceiling or all of these things are being used as some type of fig leaf to provide cover for cutting some of these social insurance programs. And you guys are doing a lot of organizing right now around that. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is an issue which is really mobilizing the progressive base coming off of the victory on November 6th and Obama's reelection and getting some more progressive members in the Senate and getting some more Democrats in the House as well. I mean, the important thing to remember here is that the president won this reelection on basically a platform that started with getting rid of the Bush tax cuts for the top 2%. And that's a historic shift that a Democrat would win election or reelection on a tax agenda, one that isn't about cutting taxes, but is actually about raising the taxes and making the tax system fairer. And also, we saw in that election by substantial majorities that the American people don't want to see any changes in Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. They want those benefits. They want those programs intact. They're important in people's lives, and this is by substantial majorities. So our expectation is that Congress and the president need to make good on the mandate and the results of the election, which first and foremost, it's around the Bush tax cuts for the top 2%. And this is not about there is no fiscal cliff. I mean, let's face it, there are some legal problems that we have because certain programs expire at the end of the year. But if we went over, that expiration date into next year, nothing drastic is going to happen to the economy.
No, I mean, I think at one point, I mean, it's just a question of ultimately some of these things are we're going to have to do some work on some of these. I mean, you know, whether it's the backloaded sequestering or the end of unemployment benefits or a whole series of smaller issues, I think that you know, obviously we can. You know, people, we can statutorily grandfather some of these things in. So that's not the main issue. My concern is basically how this is being used as, like I say, as a fig leaf. Now, what do you think? Just yesterday, we're hearing from some members in the House caucus, Republican House caucus members, who are saying maybe we can strike a deal to raise the taxes on every dollar after 250 grand. But I see this as a mechanism for the Republicans to maintain what I think is actually even far worse than the 3 percentage points on every dollar after 250 grand. But this special tax that we have essentially for investors, what we call the capital gains tax, that any movement we see from Republicans on the marginal tax rate over 250 is going to come at the expense of them trying to maintain the cuts in capital gains and the estate tax.
Well, they may try to do that. And you have a very good point that basically the capital gains rate and the dividend rate, which used to be at the same level as taxing ordinary income, is now half of it, more than half of it, and allows people like Mitt Romney to earn a fortune and pay less taxes than the average American, less percentage of his income in taxes. But I don't see that all happening in the lame duck session.
Mm-hmm.
That's the second phase of a fight that we need to have. I don't see that stuff is going to be grandfathered in a lame duck session. I really think that we need to look at this first and foremost. We can't win everything we want in one fell swoop. We need to look at kind of like what the most important thing is. We need to win now and then build up a head of steam so that we can have other progressive victories along the way. For the Republican, my viewpoint is for the Republicans to accept getting rid of the Bush tax cuts for those families bringing in over $250,000 a year would be a huge political victory. They would basically be admitting political defeat coming out of the election. It would be a great boon for us moving forward, and then we would have a head of steam to deal with these deeper and more pressing problems with fairness in our tax system. That's how I view it. I always take kind of like the long view and a strategic approach to how we need to deal with these things. We need to take the first big step to getting our tax system fairer, and then we need to deal the Republicans a big political blow, a defeat. And then they're weakened, we're strengthened, and we can move on to other things.
All right, so U.S. Action is holding some events, right? Is that right? Over on is it on Saturday the 1st?
This Saturday, U.S. Action, along with many other organizations, are holding a whole series of actions across the country. I believe it's going to be in about 30 states, focusing on target members of Congress, primarily Republicans, and their actions around ending the Bush tax cuts for the top 2%, and their actions, their canvasses, earned media events, letter writing, phone calls, mass meetings, a variety of different activities to bring attention to this issue, to raise it up further, to put pressure on particularly Republican members. Because ultimately, we need, in order for this to happen, before the end of the year, we need to turn some Republican members of Congress.
And now, why is it just Republican members? I mean, I know there are Democratic members who have been more than flirtatious with the idea of putting some of the social insurance programs on the table in response to this.
Well, it's not all Republicans. It's primarily throughout the month of December. There'll be a lot of other activities. There's another big day of action on December 10th that will involve a much broader array of targets, including a lot of Democrats getting our champions more involved, making sure that the squishy kind of middle of the road Democrats don't try to don't try to abandon progressive principles in this fight. We're kind of like, you know, nonpartisan when it comes to we believe that every member of Congress should be held accountable on December 1st. We're particularly going after Republicans because they need to really feel the heat on this. They lost the election. They lost the election because of this issue, and they need to just own the fact that they were defeated and basically just throw in the towel and accept reality, which is that the Bush tax cuts to the top 2% have to go.
Yeah, you know, I was just going to say that on the I can't remember off the top of my head now, in terms of the cracks that we're seeing, I think it was Tom Cole from Oklahoma who came out and sort of conceded on that, on at least on that, like I say, that the marginal tax rate increase. But there was polls, I think, that came out today or yesterday that said that 60% to 37% were in favor of increasing taxes on that first dollar after 250 grand.
Absolutely. And those are consistent numbers, by the way. We've seen those for, quite frankly, several years. It's just that we never had a electoral outcome which basically happened because of that issue.
Right.
So it's much more powerful politically right now. And the Republicans, you know, I'm not going to, go so far as to say that, Republicans are courageous or brave to accept defeat. The defeat that they had in November is a reality, and they just need to own up to it. And from their point of view, they just need to live to fight other battles another day.
Right. Well, Alan Charney, and people can check it out at usaction.org. We'll put a link up on our site at majority.fm. But thanks for coming on and letting us know what you guys are up to.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.